A Biblical Theory of Sexuality, Part 1. A talk in the series Issues in a Biblical Worldview was presented by Jack Crabtree on April 7, 1992, at McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2015. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side. The following recording was made in a classroom setting, and some of the students' questions were inaudible. It is hoped that Dr. Crabtree's answers will be sufficient to understand the context.
Okay, we're going to talk for the next 3 weeks on a biblical theory of sexuality. My main problem is that there's really not enough time in the 3 weeks that we have here to deal with it in the kind of detail and at length in the way that I would like to. So I'm going to have to select topics and the things that I discuss. So there'll be some gaps, and maybe the way to fill that in is to just let you interact with this in a way that we go in the direction that is most helpful and most interesting to you. So I have a strategy mapped out here, but I'm willing to go whatever way you need to go to answer your questions, or to best address the questions that you have about marriage, and I'll explain why in a second, and then get into a biblical theory of sex. Then next week, get into a biblical theory of sexual ethic, and then in the last week, we'll talk about, I guess I've titled it A Biblical Theory of Romance. I guess what I really mean is my theory of romance, but I oftentimes begin to think of it as the same thing, but sometimes it's helpful to make the distinction. The reason I want to start with marriage is just for a very simple reason, and that is, I think from a biblical perspective, sex was made for marriage, not marriage for sex. And only when we understand that do we really begin to understand sexuality as God intended it and purposed it from the biblical point of view. Now, that's a radical claim these days. In academic circles, I think it would just be taken for granted that marriage is a human institution, a human device, that mankind has invented to channel their sexual energy and to express their sexuality. And being a human device and a human institution as culture changes and as people's thinking changes, the institution can change and we can find other ways to manage our sexuality besides old-fashioned marriage. But I'm going to argue exactly the opposite. What I'm going to argue is that what God intended for us as human beings was marriage, and he created us as sexual beings in order to promote and enhance and otherwise serve the purposes of marriage. That's the position that I'm taking. So I'll start. I won't spend a lot of time on marriage. I mean, obviously, we could spend all 3 weeks on marriage, and even beyond that, there's a lot to talk about marriage, the nature of marriage, and all that. I'm not going to talk about marriage at length. I'm just going to lay out a theory of marriage enough to understand the role that sexual intimacy plays in relationship to marriage. I think we have what amounts to a biblical definition of marriage in Genesis 2. At least I have taken it to be a definition. That's what I'm basing my conclusions on. In Genesis 2, chapter 24, after the creation of Eve, Moses, or whoever, comments, "For this cause a man shall leave his father and his mother and shall cleave to his wife, and they shall become one flesh." It seems to me that he's saying that there's this fundamentally unique relationship that can happen between a man and a woman that we call marriage. It has two aspects to it. The one is captured by the phrase, "A man shall leave his father and mother and shall cleave to his wife." And then the other one is, "And they shall become one flesh." The first part, "leave father and mother and cleave to his wife," I think talks about how this relationship involves making your spouse the most special person in your life. And I have tried to think of another word besides special, but I just can't. But the connotations of that are not the greatest. But that's, I think, what he's saying. To make your husband or your wife the most special person in your life. When this was written, I think it's fair to say that in the time and place and culture in which these words were penned, one's parents, one's family, and especially one's parents, would have been your greatest human loyalty. You were loyal to your parents above and beyond any other human loyalty on the face of the earth. And in fact, I think it's an indication that this is not a product of that culture that these words could even be pinned. I mean, these transcend the cultural values. This is a truth that actually brings the cultural practices of that time into judgment. Because this is saying, a man shall leave his father and mother and shall cleave to his wife. The cultural practice was to bring your wife along like almost like property and go on living with your family. And this is saying, on the contrary, the nature of this relationship that is implied in the creation of Eve for Adam, the nature of this relationship is such that you should be committed to your wife in a way such that you forsake your family, your parents. You shift your loyalty off of them and you give your loyalty to your wife instead. And she becomes the greatest human loyalty in your life. The only loyalty that would surpass it would be your loyalty to God. So that's the first aspect of marriage. The second one is, and they shall become one flesh. Typically, people tend to take that as a statement about physical intimacy, that is, physical connectedness, even the act of sexual intimacy. But I don't think that's what that means. I don't think that's what he's saying. That flesh doesn't simply have to denote the physical body. Flesh is oftentimes used in both Hebrew and in Greek. The corresponding Hebrew and Greek is used to describe the whole of our physical existence. Paul, for example, at one point says, while I am in the flesh, I do my part on behalf of the body of Christ to fill up the sufferings of Christ or whatever. But when he says, while I'm in the flesh, what he means is, as long as I'm a living, breathing human being here on this earth, in this time and space, well, the flesh is simply a word to describe my physical existence. Not even physical existence, but this worldly existence, this age, physical existence in this age. I think that's more the sense in which it's being used here. For the two, they shall become one flesh, means that their lives are to be so merged and so intertwined with one another that no longer do their lives look like two separate individual people living out two independent lives. Rather, they are partners in living one life together. We would probably use the word life here in our idiom rather than flesh. And the two will live one life would be perhaps the way we would express it. That we become so interdependent upon one another by throwing in our lives together that what happens impacts us both together as partners in this life so that we are making a commitment to not be isolated from one another and insulated from one another. I don't insulate myself from my wife. I rather enter in with her into the joys and the sorrows and the fears and so on of life so that they impact me too. And that I, now, having said that, I think what's being described here is an agreement, is a covenant, it's a commitment that we make. This doesn't happen naturally. This is not just something that is true. This is something that I resolve to make true in a marriage relationship. But I think the idea, as it comes out of this narrative here in Genesis, is that what the author of Genesis is saying is, it was to that purpose that Eve was created for Adam. She was created for the purpose of them entering together into a relationship where they would be loyal to one another to the highest possible degree for a human being. And they would be intertwined with one another's lives to such an extent that it is best to view them as living one life together rather than two separate lives. Now, it doesn't say it here, but putting the rest of the data and the clues together from the Bible, the other characteristics of biblical marriage would be that it's permanent. That is, I remember going to a talk once where the guy defined a relationship as a permanent relationship for a while. Well, this is a permanent relationship for a longer while than that. That the nature of this relationship, it would really be a contradiction to make someone the most special person in your life until you don't. The rejection that would come from withdrawing making them the most special person in your life would more than undo anything that would have been accomplished by making them the most special person in your life. The whole point and the whole purpose of marriage in terms of what it is satisfying and fulfilling to us about it is in its permanence. The emotional and psychological satisfaction that comes from being special to another human being is only accomplished when I know that that commitment is going to last, and is not going to be withdrawn. So the permanence is a very, 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 I mean, is an absolutely critical, essential feature of the marriage commitment. So from a biblical perspective, it's a permanent commitment for as long as we both shall live. When I was a pastor in California doing preaching, I married some people who wanted to write their own vows and wanted to say, for as long as we both shall love. And I said, well, there's a justice of the peace down the road that'll do that. And they said, oh, okay, no, for as long as we both shall live. And then in the actual wedding ceremony, live was slurred ever so effectively. I don't know. It's monogamous, one man, one woman, which I think is implied here, but yeah. So it's a monogamous, permanent, leave and cleave, one flesh kind of relationship, and it is heterosexual. That's the biblical view of marriage. Now, let me just because it's an issue these days, let me comment just briefly on, and this may be all we say about it, but comment briefly on the heterosexual part of it. The Bible does not answer the question that is my question, that is raised by modern culture, and that is why heterosexual. And what I mean by why heterosexual is, if you look at the other aspects of the relationship, permanent, monogamous, one flesh, leave and cleave, there's nothing there inherently that couldn't describe a unique kind of friendship, and even, therefore, a homosexual, monogamous, permanent, committed relationship. And there's nothing about what I've said so far that would rule that out, presumably. So the question that's raised is, well, what's being accomplished between a man and a woman in marriage that couldn't also be true between a woman and a woman and a man and a man? Yeah, yeah. But I think you have to step back. I think you have to ask a question even further back. Why didn't God create us all one sex and have babies formed by little nodules that grew out of the side of your head? Or whatever. or whatever. You know, whatever. Something more beautiful. Could have, right? So what is he accomplishing, but why didn't he? That is, why? What is he accomplishing by creating different sexes? Yeah. And I think only when we could answer that could we answer the question that I'm asking, and that is, well, what, in terms of the emotions of it, in terms of the psychology of it, in terms of whether it is and in what way it is or is not fulfilling or satisfying to part of our humanity, what is it about the sexual differentiation that contributes to what is right and proper and appropriate and natural and satisfying about marriage? Unfortunately, for our purposes, as far as I know, the Bible doesn't address that question. It doesn't address it at that level. It only goes to the level that you described, that the Bible, it seems to me, is compatible with what we might call a natural law kind of ethic. It condones the notion that we could look at God's creation and the structure and structures of God's creation and learn something from that. And we can figure something out from that. And it assumes that what we can figure out just by looking at things like human psychology, sexual differences, anatomical differences, and so on, and looking at our own instincts and desires, what we can learn from that is, for whatever reasons, God intended heterosexual marriages. And the Bible clearly comes to the conclusion and argues in that way for heterosexual marriages being God's intention, and talks about any violation of that as being a rebellion against the created order, and therefore a rebellion against God, the will of God. That much is clear, I think. I think the Bible clearly teaches that. But if you ask the deeper question of, well, why did he do it that way? And what was he accomplishing by doing it that way? We just don't have an answer to that. And all we can do at that point would be to speculate. My speculation is that there is something being accomplished by having this commitment be across differences, someone other than me. Yeah. And that the commitment being a commitment to someone who is truly another, who is as fundamentally different from me as man is from woman, and that that's about as fundamentally different as you can get among human beings, I would argue. That by it having be a commitment to another, there's some purpose in that, there's some virtue in that that caused that to be what God wanted to do, wanted to make a part of his design. Sure. I think what you're saying is really true, and I need to think about that some more. To make that the foundation of a sexual ethic would require me to adjust all of my thinking, which I'm not prepared to do right now, but I think that's true. I mean, that's a good point. Yeah, that's the fundamental point that I want to make, is that in terms of an underlying method for establishing a sexual ethic, that's the biblical method is completely and radically different from modern day assumptions about that. You actually hear it said explicitly by some people that my sexuality has no design. My sexuality is not for anything. It's just there, and I decide what it's for, how it's to be used, how it's to be employed, and so on. I mean, those are the modern assumptions. I mean, most people don't even think about it. Most people don't think philosophically about it. But when they do today, that's the position they take. So the notion, for example, especially among activist homosexual groups, the notion that your anatomy is made to correspond in a particular way is scoffed at. Right? Just, I decide what my anatomy is capable of. But yeah, it's so, yeah. And that's the biblical argument, is that it takes an act of rebellion on my part to become so blind to the plain, simple, glaring reality that God intended a particular thing. Mm-hmm. And let's always keep this in perspective. It's by the grace of God that you and I don't right. think exactly that way. I mean, look at the things I'm blind to. My tendency to think that life is for stuff, for example. Toys, that's what life is all about. Or fame, or power. Or there are all kinds of things that all of us, at some level, are blind to. That if we only had the eyes to see, we'd see how stupid it was that I could possibly think that way and see it that way. And if someone's blind spot happens to be at the area of their sexuality and sexual orientation, it's fundamentally no different than my blindness as well. I think it's conceivable, yeah. I mean, I don't see anything that would necessarily, yeah, let's say a struggling homosexual. Just like you can be a struggling materialist and a struggling greedy person and a struggling racist. Okay, I want to go on to sex itself, but marriage, anything else on the theory of marriage? So it seems to me that from marriage, then, we can come to understand what, on one hand, from marriage, and on the other hand, kind of an analysis of sexual intimacy itself, we can come to see how the one serves the other. I would analyze sexual intimacy into three things. Procreation is an obvious one. That's one aspect of sexual intimacy. It involves and is intended to involve procreation. Secondly, it's intended to involve physical pleasure. And then thirdly, and I will argue most importantly, it's intended to involve an intimate knowledge of one another. And I have to unpack that and define that. But it's intended to involve intimate knowledge of my spouse. I think it's not just euphemism when the Old Testament, when Hebrews speak of, and so-and-so knew his wife, and she conceived. And I don't think it's a pretty earthy culture. I don't think that was what motivated them. I think when they say Adam knew his wife and conceived, it's describing a profound insight into the nature of sexual intimacy. In sexual intimacy, I think when practiced according to the purpose of sex in marriage, that is, it's monogamous, faithfully monogamous and permanent, then what I am doing in sexual intimacy is I am giving of myself, I am giving my partner a knowledge of me that I withhold from everyone else. And it's really basically one of the only things that I can righteously and lovingly withhold from anyone else. And there really, I can't think of too many things, if anything, that I should be unwilling. Any other knowledge of myself, it seems to me that righteously I ought to be completely and utterly transparent and reveal anything and everything about myself. But there's this one thing that I won't give you, and that's I won't let you know my body. So by having this thing about me, namely an intimate knowledge of my body, that I withhold from everyone except this one person, then that becomes a very dramatic currency, a very dramatic symbol, a dramatic way of communicating to my spouse that you are special. I will withhold nothing from you at all. My loyalty to you extends to such an extent that everything that is mine is yours. Everything about me is yours and belongs to you, even my body. I give my body to you as well. And in that way, it gives expression to something that needs to be true and ought to be true in every area of our lives. If my body is yours, my money is yours, my time is yours, my support, my emotional support is yours, my respect is yours, my loyalty is yours. I mean, there's nothing that I have to give that I do not offer to you, because the most intimate thing to me, the most centrally me, is my body, And I give that to you. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. And I think that's exactly the perversion in our culture, is that we've turned that completely on its head. To give my body is to give nothing and promise nothing. You have to earn the rest somehow. Yeah, and that's exactly turned on its head. Now, what I will argue, though, and we'll look at a passage, and I'll try to support this from the passage, but I think the biblical perspective, and I think you can see it, I see it in country western films, but in various parts of our culture, is that it's simply a human psychological reality, what I would call the psychogenital connection, that there's something about the way our psychology is wired, that we accept intimacy with one another's bodies, and particularly genital contact for some reason, as implicitly making a statement. That is, our psychology is wired such that if you are sexually intimate with me, that is tantamount to a promise of commitment to me, and vice versa. We are making a commitment to one another. We may not follow through on our commitment. We may not take it seriously. We can shine it on. That is, we can be irresponsible about this thing. But what we can't do, it seems to me, fundamentally, is we can't have sex and say, it don't mean nothing. And what I mean by country western songs is, you know the song where you meet at a bar and you decide to go to a motel room together, and you decide ahead of time before you go to the motel room that this doesn't mean anything, and then you spend the night together, and then you ask the question the next morning, we decided ahead of time that it doesn't mean anything, so why do I feel rotten right now that you left me? And we are confounded by this phenomenon, is that as much as we try to make sex meaningless, we cannot do it. Now, I need to qualify that. We can do it, but we can only do it at the cost of our own soul, only by brutalizing my own psyche. That is, I can turn myself into an animal. I can decide to be an animal, to think like an animal, to act like an animal, and feel like an animal, but only by becoming an animal. I can't remain a fully functioning, reasonable, noble human being and not recognize that sex means something. It inherently and intrinsically is a language that God built into our body. And whether I like it or not, the meaning of the language of sex is, I'm committed to you, I love you, you're special, and I'm going to stay with you. So we feel betrayed even when we've tried to be modern 20th century existentialists who are making our own meaning and finding our own way and finding our own significance and even redefining our sexuality. We can't even succeed at doing it. So it seems to me, to back up then, that that's the purpose for sex as God intended it. The purpose is, it's this language whereby I can say to my husband or wife on an ongoing, continuing basis, it's a way of ratifying my marriage vows, ratifying my commitment. I love you. I am making you the most special person in my life. We're going to live this life together as one. Everything is yours. Everything of mine is yours. Now, if that's true, and here's why I was hesitating in immediately adopting Logan's theory. I think what you're saying is true and needs to be incorporated in here somehow. But it seems to me that the fundamental purpose of sex is not procreation. It is a very, very obviously important aspect to it. But I don't think it's the fundamental purpose of it. Because human sexuality, I think, is intended to be, you know, just not just procreative. Not just a biological function. It's fundamentally a moral, spiritual, psychological reality where this moral commitment that I've made to my best friend is expressed in a dramatic way, and the expression of it comes back and enhances and even affects the commitment. I mean, it plays back on itself in a way that I'm not sure what the dynamic of that is. I'm not sure how to analyze the dynamic of that, but I would say just my experience is that it seems to me that it helps forge and form and shape and nurture the commitment of sex. Questions on that?
Right, exactly. Yeah, that's right. That's right.
You may be able to anticipate this, and I won't have time to develop all of this, but where this ultimately takes us is a very radical critique of our culture in a lot of different ways. But it seems to me that biblical sexual ethics is fundamentally old-fashioned. I mean, it really is, and really old-fashioned. And I think if anything is really wrong with our Christian subculture today, is that we are totally messed up in our sexual ethics. There was a good article in Last Christianity Today by Tim Stafford, where he was suggesting that in the light of AIDS, he was saying that, I would say, in the light of what the Bible teaches about sexuality, quite apart from AIDS, but in the light of the AIDS epidemic, Christians are in a position where if they're going to survive as Christians, that is, if their Christianity is going to remain intact, they're going to have to create a sexual subculture. And I have thought that for about 10 years, long before AIDS. That is, that a sexual subculture would be totally appropriate, because the implications of the modern view of sexuality are so radically different from the implications of the biblical view of sexuality that everything is ultimately affected. The way we relate to each other, I mean, just a simple notion like modesty. Modesty is appropriate, it seems to me, in a biblical view of things. But how far are you going to get teaching on modesty in church today? Although it would save them cost in making their modesty even, and I haven't always thought this, but I'm beginning to see now. If you even read a book on sexual technique or kind of a marriage manual by an evangelical Christian today, the degree of emphasis that they put on things like simultaneous orgasm, just the stress that they put on pleasure in sex, is a misplaced emphasis. Way back in the 60s, there was a book called Total Woman by Maribel Morgan. And I think there were a lot of problems with that book. But, you know, at the time, I just kind of laughed at it. And I didn't really see how fundamentally wrong it was. But I think I do now, where she describes one thing you can do if your husband is, I can't even remember, you know, but meet your husband at the door, and I can't remember how you're dressed, but wrapped in, yeah. So all these hints from Heloise, yeah. Sexual hints from Heloise on how you can, well, on the one hand, at the time I just thought that was sort of basically innocent but strange. But now I'm beginning to see that I think actually underlying that is a misunderstanding of what sexuality is all about. Sex is not primarily for pleasure any more than it's primarily for reproduction. It is pleasurable, and it can be a whole lot more pleasurable at some times than other times. But the bread and butter sex of a man and his wife will be what will always be true, no matter how you perform sexually, no matter whether you do it right or not, no matter whether it's textbook or not textbook. It will always be intimate, and you will always be giving an intimate knowledge of yourself. You will always be offering your body to your partner. It's a much quieter, more subtle satisfaction than orgasm, than heightened pleasure in orgasm. But the point I'm making is, it seems to me that any more than procreation is the point of sex, neither is pleasure the purpose and the point of sex. You haven't somehow missed out on what God intended for sexual intimacy if it's not the most pleasurable experience in your life. And yet by reading some of these books, you almost get the impression that it is your Christian duty to have a better orgasm next time than you had this time, until finally you can reach the perfect orgasm, maybe. I mean, obviously they don't say it in so many words, but that's the direction of their thinking. Josh McDowell at one point was doing a series of lectures on what maximum sex. How can you have maximum sex? Become a Christian. You can have maximum sex. Now, it was more complicated than that. It was more involved in that. And much of what he says, I'm sure, was really appropriate and right. But even the fact that you would market it that way involves, I think, a hidden assumption that's fundamentally wrong. And that is that when all is said and done, we need to double our pleasure and double our fun. Well, I'll talk about this more next week, but just in brief, fundamentally, sex outside of marriage is a lie. Because I can't help, the reality is, whether I will admit it or not, whether I will acknowledge it or not, I'm making a promise whenever I am sexually intimate with someone. I'm making a promise to them. And if I'm not prepared to follow through and keep the promise that I've made in the rest of our lives together, then I'm lying to them. And lying is cruel, and deceit is cruel, unloving, unkind, and just basically not nice. You don't lie. Pardon me? Then I think you're in a more, I still will argue, I think that's inappropriate, and I will argue that it is, but it's in a morally different place than the other. Those are not equivalent moral realities, but, or emotional realities. Which part? I can't support that biblically. The closest I can come will be to argue that I think Paul is assuming that body-me connection and the promissory nature of sexuality in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, and I'll look at that next week. We don't have time right now, but we'll look at that next week. And basically, the picture that I painted, I would argue, is implicit in his argument there. The notion of specialness being the fundamental and primary purpose of sex, that I don't know where you could find any biblical support for that, that's more an analysis of experience on my part. Every sex act does not result in procreation. Some have argued, therefore, shame on you. But I don't think that's right. I mean, if you just look at biological realities, God didn't design it for every sex act to result in procreation. So just like we read nature to draw conclusions about heterosexuality versus homosexuality, I think you can legitimately come to some conclusions about what God intended for sexuality from that biological reality. And actually the same is true, I'd make the same argument for pleasure. Sex is not always the same thing in terms of its relationship to pleasure. Not the same thing is not happening. And again, if you come with the right grid, you argue that's because something's wrong with you. But I guess all I can do is just challenge that, and you need to decide for yourself whether I'm right. It doesn't seem to me that that's a result of anything wrong with it. I think that's the way sex is. Okay? We're out of time. Any last questions? So we'll try to apply these principles to try to figure out principles of sexual ethics next week. I hadn't intended to. The fact that there's polygamy? No. I have to say, I've never been particularly bothered by that, and therefore I've never studied it at any depth. I've just always assumed that those guys are wrong. Their polygamy was just a distortion. And I've never actually looked to see this for sure, but I don't think you can ever find it condoned in the Old Testament. I don't think there's anything that could be construed as an unambiguous affirmation of what they're doing. Okay, we'll continue this next week.